Detective Night Country episode 2 is over, but here on Post Show Recaps, we are just getting started. My name is Grace, but of course I'm not alone. I'm here with Dr. Amanda. Amanda, how are you doing?
Grace, you're asking the wrong questions. Oh. It's not how am I doing. It's where am I doing?
What are you doing?
What am I doing?
You're watching the bodies, though, I think. That's the deal. Yes. To make sure they don't wake up.
Mm-hmm. No. Oh, I hate it when that happens, when you have frozen dead bodies and one of them wakes up. What a way to start an episode.
Can I say, did that happen? Because that happens and then nobody is like, wow, remember when the body woke up?
Yeah. I do feel like they didn't. Yeah, we'll get into everything.
I know. I'm like, that, really getting nitty gritty. Yeah.
There wasn't enough to do about that. I completely agree. Then part of me was like, wait, did I hallucinate that? Maybe I have polar madness. I'm really into this series so far. I thought this was a great episode. The case is definitely intriguing. And I really don't want to live in the Arctic Circle, Grace. I don't want to do it.
Yeah. I'm about as close to the Arctic Circle as I would like to be in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a very nice summer. Toronto's a great summer city. I'll take that. I don't need to live in darkness.
You have days and nights and they're separate.
Seasons. Like a short summer, like a short spring normally, but you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
I really like this episode as well. I think it gives a lot. It's weird to say that this is a third of the way through the season. So it does feel like when I'm thinking like, wow, that's a lot of information we're getting. I also have to know that they're a third of the way through the season. By next episode, they'll be halfway through. So it makes sense that we're on a bit of a quick pace and lots happening. But I thought, once again, I thought the balance of this episode is really good. We get so many moments. I think it's going to become a little bit of a trope here. We're like, scenes will end with Danvers getting a call or a radio signal being like, Chief, you're never going to believe this. And she goes, and there's a new piece of information.
Yeah.
But I thought, so a little bit of a hype for the deep dive that's going to happen this week. We will be interviewing together at the same time, Isabella Starr LeBlanc, who plays Leah, and then Anna Lamb, who plays Kayla. Excited to chat with them. We're going to interview them together. So, and both of them, we found out we're going to get the interview, and then I was watching the episode. It was like, oh yeah, they're in this episode, maybe even more than they were last episode. So I think, I think that the balance of, you know, there's a lot of people in this cast and a lot of things to do. And I do feel like, this is definitely like the Danvers and Navarro story, but we learned a lot about Hank and Peter this episode, about Leah, about there's more Eddie stuff in the scene. So it's really well balanced, I think, so far.
Well, that's incredible. I'm really excited to listen to you and Jess have those interviews. I think that you've done a great job on the deep dives, Grace. No surprise. I made a comment in the Discord that I think we're going to solve this one. Like, I think we're going to know who did it. Yeah. But again, is that the right question, Grace?
Yeah, that is interesting that it's the right question, because we posited on the we have this game where we're going to try to like sort of lock in our guess as to what's happening with the mystery. And if you keep your guess from week one, then you're going to get 6 months, whatever. It's a little convoluted, but it's a little fun. And we're like, well, there's two mysteries. And then I very quickly said, like, we could try to guess who killed Annie, but I actually don't think that this is the point of the show, is to do. And I think, you know, about missing and murdered Indigenous women, the story is not, oh my gosh, who's doing it? The story is like, why does it keep happening and why do people keep getting away with it? And so the idea that it's just going to be Raymond who did it would not surprise me in the slightest, because the story can be like, yeah, but how did nobody see that this was happening and how did he get away with it? Right. So that is not the mystery. I think the mystery is more so, how come these particular men went missing? What's the deal with the mine,
the connection to the mine and the water and all of this. Exactly. So I'm really excited to dig into all of that.
Yeah. So make sure you subscribe for all the podcasts we're doing each week, postrecaps.com/truedetective. We are also, I believe, each episode of our recaps are on YouTube. So you can watch our delightful faces on youtube.com/postrecaps. And the schedule for the week, of course, Dr. Mander and I are here after each episode. We will be live on YouTube. Our video will air on YouTube at the end of each episode on Sunday nights, but we will be live for the finale on YouTube. Jess and I will do the deep dive a couple of days after, with hopefully some guests and interviews along the way. And then Mike Bloom and LaTanya Starks are doing their Versus pod, which has been a treat so far. So check that out. That's the coverage. Yeah, I mean, the quick plot recap of episode two is Danvers continues to explore what happened. They're going to move the bodies out there, you know, investigating what happened to the bodies. And as it becomes clear that the tongue is Annie's through DNA, she's going to start looping in Navarro, who is still pretty much on the case and also dealing with all of these things in her personal life with her sister, Julie. As I said, we get a little bit more into Hank and Peter and Kayla. There's some more confrontation between Leah and her mom about Leah wanting to get to know her culture and her heritage despite having a white mother. So we move along with more evidence. And as we get closer to finding out that potentially it for sure was Raymond Clark who did it, surprise, surprise, he's not in the pile of bodies. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, he's gone. Where do you want to start, Dr. Amanda?
Well, let's see. I mean, I do think that's so one of the things that I was fastidiously focused on in this episode was keeping track of all of the scientists, frozen or otherwise.
Yeah.
And I have all of their names.
It's hard when their bodies are breaking apart. Limbs are coming off. They're melting.
Oof. Yeah. This macabre sculpture of like frozen bodies is really, really terrifying. It's quite a thing. And
this could have been out of the curse, Amanda. This art piece. Yeah.
Yes, it's art and I get it. All right, everybody, cool down. I get it. I think names are very significant in this show, Grace.
We clocked Raymond Clark is was a Yale researcher who murdered an undergraduate student at Yale. It does seem like named Annie. Just seems like he's fully named after a 2011 murderer. So, yeah, tough.
So I think that's a pretty on the nose there, on the frostbitten nose, Raymond Clark. The other scientists, among their names are Ralph Emerson, you know, which is pretty evocative. Ralph Waldo Emerson is obviously the American author, and one of the things that he is known for is, you know, his connection to Henry David Thoreau and this sort of isolationism. He wrote this epic poem called The Adirondacks that was about a party of travelers, of all male party, who went to be isolated up in the mountains of New York, the Adirondacks. It's a long poem. I skimmed it, but there might be some interesting nuggets there. Also, the name Sala. Did you and Jess talk about this? It's
Edgar Allan Poe, right? Inspired. I think I mentioned it, but that's about it. That's about
there is an Edgar Allan Poe poem that evokes the name Sala. There's also a Jules Verne story called The Antarctic Mystery. It follows a captain who survived an assassination attempt at Salal. So there's a lot of these different references that kind of evoke the idea of a party of men living in isolation for some kind of intellectual pursuit. And then I know you pointed out there was also this case of Russian hikers that sort of mirrors some of the details of this case.
The Dyatlov Pass incident. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that there's going to be this sort of theme of this like monistic group of men who are engaged in some intellectual endeavor. And we get a little bit more details about what is going on in Salal through one of, I guess, Elizabeth Danvers, many romantic entanglements who have a science teacher.
Yeah. There's also Kate who seems to own the mine. Potentially she was romantically involved with the mine owner. We don't know before or after the divorce. So Liz,
she's getting out there. That Tinder comment was not far off. So I think that I think that the names are very interesting, and they're at least sort of thematically related to this idea of, you know, we have this group of men who go off to this place to pursue something, you know, very, very lofty, and something goes wrong and there's a mental breakdown. So I'm definitely following that. We also finally find out what Pete learned from tracking the financing of Salal, and there seems to be this NGO that's related to a shell company that has business in all of these different areas. So I love all the different layers of intrigue that we're getting here, Grace.
Yeah. Well, let me start with asking a question that's hopefully right, which is, let's start with Danvers. We meet Connolly, played by Christopher Eccleston. I know that that's Christopher Eccleston. Don't worry.
Are you sure, Grace?
Well, you know, who knows? You never know. And he shows up, and the central thing here is, well, we should move the case to Anchorage. They have more resources. They'll be able to handle it. And Danvers, sort of once again proving that she's an excellent detective, she's very good at her job, starts literally reading the manual to him, being like, don't you know that you have to like carefully thaw the bodies? And if you don't do it properly, you're going to ruin all the evidence. And it's the biggest piece of evidence we have. And then we learn that they're romantically involved for, is it 13, 17?
19 years. 19,
it was 17. And then she says, no, 19. So that can't be possible. That's before I was married.
Oopsies.
And they go back into it again about, he keeps thinking like, you're only doing this to, you know, get at me. You're trying to like, you know, get under my skin by deciding to keep the case. You know, I do think Danvers is definitely being, you know, like the bodies in the hockey rink being thawed by Navarro, by wanting, the more that there's evidence that this is definitely, there's some link to Annie, sees that, okay, let's do this together. But is that the sole motivation for Danvers to take this case? We talk about this a lot. It's one of my favorite things, like the epiphanies I had about Succession, is that people don't do things for one reason. So I just said, is it the sole reason? Like, you know, 75% she could be doing out of the goodness of her heart, 25% is because like she thinks she'll earn her promotion or something, right? Like those two things can exist at the same time. So, but why does Danvers decide to keep the case? She doesn't seem particularly like, you know, attached to the case. She doesn't, you know, in some ways we often see these, you know, like a Sherlock Holmes type who's like, I must solve, this is so intriguing to me, I must solve this case. Like there's a little bit of that. She seems very good at it, but she doesn't seem like she particularly loves anything.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like after the first episode, I think that I still was giving Liz a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt as a character. And I think in this episode, there's more evidence that she's just an a-hole. And over the past week, I've listened to some interviews with Issa Lopez, who's the writer and director of this series, and that like when she originally presented the Danvers character to Jodie Foster, the sort of driving force of that character was a woman who was always on the verge of a breakdown, who had suffered this loss and was barely holding it together. And Jodie Foster was not interested in playing that character. And that through the process, Danvers became more of just a jerk. And that was what Jodie Foster wanted to play. And Issa Lopez has said that we have all of these male anti-hero characters, these Tony Sopranos, these Walter Whites. We don't get to see a woman who embodies that type of character. And in this episode, I saw much more evidence that Liz is actually a jerk. You know, we see her being extremely inconsiderate of Pete Pryor and his family, and like kind of forcing him to sit there and watch TikToks in front of the fleshsicle. We also see her being like extremely dismissive of her adoptive daughter's, you know, desires to explore her native heritage. Racist, I'll say that she's racist and says racist things to Navarro about like spirit animals, and very dismissive. And then we get this evidence that, you know, she's been implicated in a few different cheating situations, I think both on both sides of that equation. So we definitely get this view that, you know, she is not a warm and fuzzy type of character at all. She's probably a little bit selfish, probably a little bit, you know, inconsiderate or dismissive of other people's feelings, but she's very smart. She's probably the only competent person on this police force, especially now that Navarro is over with the troopers. Everybody around her, they can't move a body without breaking something. They're taking selfies. Like, it's like this place is a mess.
Pete has some potential. He unlocks the phone with the face recognition. And that's maybe why she's willing to take her under his wing. But the other piece that comes up this episode, and I do agree that I think that this person who Danvers is right now is maybe jaded, so much so because of, you know, for many reasons. But we do get two noticeable flashbacks. There's actually three moments, I actually think, that you can highlight that. There is maybe some warmth there somewhere. And it doesn't excuse racism. It doesn't excuse, you know, some of her, like, the ways in which she treats Pete separating him from, you know, giving his son bath time. But she comes in and she sits down with Darwin. And she's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And she's like interacting with him. She seems to be actually like very kind in this way, even though she's also being like, I'm also going to make your dad work and he can't give you a bath tonight. Sorry, Darwin. The two flashbacks are a moment with Holden where they're lying on the ground and they're playing with the teddy bear. She's actually then going to put the polar bear back in the box and not look at it ever again. Maybe ever again, but just like, nope, that's good. I'm just going to put that in a box and not think about it. And then we learn that she loved to dance and she loved to dance with Leah's dad. And that was the song that they would dance to, the one that Pete's listening to in a TikTok.
It was like something from the 70s. I didn't write it down. Not the Beatles, though. We know Liz hates
Would not be the Beatles. But these are moments that Liz, maybe in the past, and there are glimpses of it, of somebody who, you know, we don't know for sure what happened with Holden and Leah's dad, but it does seem like that has changed Liz to a degree. And the only thing that she is focusing on now is Christmas lights, effing some men in this and solving this crime.
So, I mean, all good anti-heroes have these humanizing elements and some explanation for how they arrived where they are. And I think that we're getting a lot more insight into what Liz has experienced. And my guess at this point is that maybe it was Jake is the name of the former partner, Leah's father, and Holden's father. So we know that Liz was in a romantic relationship with this man who I think is a native man, as far, you know, we have every reason to believe when we see Holden in flashbacks and knowing that he's Liz's father, that Jake was Liz's father, brought that child into the relationship. Liz and Jake had a second child. That child is Holden. And then there was a car accident in which both Jake and Holden died. I'm guessing, my guess is that maybe this was like a polar bear came out into the street potentially. Wow. And that's why that might have caused the accident. Maybe there's something about the way that Liz is dismissive of Native beliefs and saying things about spirit animals, as there might be this sort of eerie connection between Holden Stuffy and the accident that actually happened with a one-eyed polar bear and a one-eyed polar bear Stuffy. And maybe there was something that Jake had said or that Holden had said that was eerily predictive of this tragic event. So this is like kind of where my mind is going right now, that could give some context to the person that Liz is today.
How much do you think that the show tries to re-soften Liz Danvers? Is this person who's an a-hole by the end of it? I don't expect a full 180, and these things that happen to you in your life, you know, grief, you know, it's so tough to come, but the idea that Navarro's trying to make her care at least about the case and at least about the things that are happening here, whereas it does feel like Danvers, I think the thing about Danvers is that she mostly seems selfish at the moment, and can, over the course of the two working together, like, how does Liz change? What is her character development over the show? I don't want her to be, you know, exactly like dancing the night away, you know, but like, you know, could you get her up on the dance floor for one dance, you know, or so, you know, something where she what does she learn from this experience working with Navarro, where they're probably actually going to hopefully solve the case?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think that the hook for where we're going to end up with Liz probably comes from whatever her motivation is to actually take this case, because there's a lot of confusion. Like, this is the type of case that Connelly says that she would call a shit bowl. She actually does call it.
I love it. She calls it, and he goes, "What's that thing you always say? A shit bowl?" Yeah, yeah. Very good.
And it's classic Danvers. But you know that there's this that she's motivated to take this case, despite the fact that other people recognize this as being out of character. Because even if she is smarter and more competent than the other people around her, she's probably also lazy or doesn't like to get involved in something that could potentially cause problems. But like, she does it anyway. And their relationship, I think, at the end, where we get Navarro and Liz teaming up, it's, she presents it as, it's very instrumental. Like, you solve your case, I solve my case. We never talk to each other again. And I wonder if beneath Liz's tough exterior, like, she's also angry that people don't get the justice that they deserve because of the mines, because of racism, because of how power is distributed in this town of Ennis. And that, like, ultimately, because Liz is the type of person who can, you know, say F you to the most powerful woman in town and then put frozen bodies in her ice rink, like, Liz knows she's the only person who will stand up to the corruption in Ennis. And even if she's selfish and even if she's an a-hole, I think that the fact that she is so tough and that she recognizes that, you know, there has been an injustice. We know that she continued to investigate Annie's case without telling Navarro about it, that she does find these connections. So she doesn't want to let this on, but that she is somewhat driven by this idea of doing what's right.
Well, I think one other piece I'm wondering here is, I wonder, we get a moment with Connelly where it's revealed that she was put here. She was placed here. This was her assignment. And I do wonder whether there's some piece of her, whether or not she's saying it, like, who would she even vocalize this to? Maybe to Connelly. She could have said this of like, when I solve this case, will you move me out? But she does have a connection. She does have Leah here. And the other piece too is the line that sticks with me is when she says, Ennis killed Annie. And I do wonder, the piece that it does feel like we seem to have a good read potentially, and we could be way wrong about what happened with Holden and Jake. The moment that moment happens is when there's a drunk driver who goes in front of her, and whether or not they were hit by a drunk driver or Jake was drunk, I do think this idea, this is a very common thing. There's a higher rates of alcoholism, again, because of systematic racism and all of these things that, like, causes people, you know, if you don't have all your basic needs met, and you know, you drink to, you know, for all these reasons. So,
and in cold weather climates, yeah, also there's higher rates of alcoholism.
Right. So is that a thing? And does she see that actually Ennis killed Jake and Holden, and in some ways she wants to put it, the polar bear, in the box and not look at it? But over the course of this case, does she realize, well, there's actually things, tangible things we can do? One of the most interesting things, I remember talking to Kevin Mahadeo once about stories, is that the one thing you don't, and you know, a different when it's and he was specifically talking, but he's like, the one thing is you don't want to do in storytelling. We were talking about D&D and playing D&D, is like, you can't solve racism in one story. And so I, you know, think about that, about what the conclusion here could be. Like, I don't think it's, you know, we're not going to solve all of Ennis's racism, systematic structures. They're much more than Ennis. Yeah. But yeah, just thinking about the end. So I will get to Navarro, but I maybe just want to touch on Leah, because it connects to Danvers, which is this moment where she goes to Kayla's house after school, seemingly. And Kayla's grandma draws these indigenous tattoos on her chin. And when Liz comes over to sort of pick up her, demands that she wash them off. She ultimately doesn't. And I feel like everybody else's interaction is like, oh, that's so cool that you did, you know, it's so cool that you're doing that thing. And she's like, oh, it's not permanent. Like, you know, whatever. A lot of people are like, oh, you finally did it. Like, you know, and then she's like, no, it's not permanent. But two things I thought was interesting in this scene is, This is the most blatant, I think, like kind of racism we see from, from Danvers. And also the most that we see stuff of like Kayla being like, you should actually get out of my house, and saying she's just trying to explore her culture, her identity. It feels like a super dramatic reaction from Danvers, but I guess I don't have children, so I don't know how I would feel if they ever tattooed themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that, you know, again, this was the scene where I was like, okay, the show now is really giving us evidence to see Liz as being, you know, selfish and racist and, you know, probably not a great person and less sympathetic than I think she even was in the first episode. But yet she calls Kayla, you know, she's like, oh, you know, she's going to be a night nurse or a like a laundromat grandma, like being very rude. And I wonder if it's, you know, getting back to the part of Danvers that might be sympathetic to finding justice, especially justice for Native women, probably in the position that she's in as the captain of the police force in Ennis, is like she sees all of the she sees all of the effects of racism on Native women, and she knows that these cases don't get investigated and solved. Maybe she sees Salal as a way to make sure justice is served for Annie. And a lot of people when faced with this, I mean, we see this with homophobia from parents. It's like out of concern for the way that they think the world is going to treat their child, they want their child to actually not embrace that part of them. And I think that we know through lots and lots of evidence that trying to protect your child by stripping them of their identity is actually very bad for their development and their mental health, but that it could come from this place where Liz says, like, even if I wasn't racist, which maybe she is, you know, the world is, and you being a Native woman here in Ennis is going to make you more susceptible to this kind of violence. Even going back to, I want to just revisit in the first episode, the video that Leah and her girlfriend made and how the mother reacts to that. You know, we first are presented with it as if Leah is like older and might be predatory towards this younger girl. And now we find out that Leah and her girlfriend are actually 16 and 17. So it would not qualify as statutory rape. And it's, you know, that age, just like, it's just a normal teenage sexual relationship, but it might be out of this other mother's homophobia and racism that this becomes something that raises to the threshold of being a problem for Liz. And like, Liz isn't like, I think Liz's reaction to this is a little bit more of like, now I have to deal with this. So I think that part of Liz's orientation would be more that she recognizes these injustices, and it may be out of a misguided attempt to protect Leah, doesn't want her to be gay, doesn't want her to embrace a Native identity.
It's very interesting to me to watch Jodie Foster play this person who's like hooking up with all the men and then be like, don't want my daughter to be gay. Very funny to me. Yes. But I think too, I mean, like, I think Danvers has like some very fair objections to like making sure, you know, making sure that your daughter doesn't make a sex tape. If you break up, it goes on the internet and like revenge porn and all this stuff. And I think the mother, for whatever reason, she doesn't want this to happen. She almost uses the idea that like her daughter is 15 as like leverage to make sure, like, you know, whatever, like that Liz takes this seriously or whatever. And it's like, then we learn like, well, she's actually 16. So, you know, I just want to talk about the Pete and Leah scene where they chat, they sit as the bodies are thawing. And there's this whole thing about Pete's relationship with his father and how, you know, we learn that Liz danced with Leah's dad, but then we learn that he wanted to play he loved the guitar and he wanted to be in band. but his mom always said that he wasn't good enough to have a career. And then there's this line of like, well, maybe she just thought he wasn't, and he doesn't finish it. And Leah says, good enough, period. And Pete says, yeah, that sticks with you, not being good enough. And I think that that's both of these characters who have a parent in the mix, in the story. I think that Leah is certainly feeling like, I'm not sure what Liz thinks of me. She's saying like, you don't have to try to be my mom. But then also like Liz is like, almost like, not super like she is and she isn't trying to really be like the most specifically of this person who is Indigenous, who wants to explore her culture, and she's not letting her do that. And then obviously we're going to get a moment between Hank and Pete where Hank's going to slap his son for having stolen the documents, which again just makes me extremely suspicious that Hank is again, I don't think he's committed murder, but I do think he's probably complicit in covering some stuff up. Yeah,
Hank is that particularly unappealing combination of incompetent and awful. Like, he's mean and he's stupid. So, you know, like we get the feeling that he's like probably a corrupt cop. Like, we have Hank's interaction with Kate McKintrick, who we know is like the person who owns the mines. And, you know, he's very, very like cozy with her. She says, we got to get that son of yours to coach hockey. And Hank's like, yeah, I'll talk some sense into it. So Hank seems much more connected and willing to toe the line of the powerful people in Ennis.
I also think Hank says something to Pete that's very important in terms of his worldview, which is, he says, Danvers doesn't own you. You have a family and she's not in. Blood is blood, Peter. Remember that. Which I take to potentially think that at a certain time that it's like, you know, blood is blood, but protect the people who you know, listen to me, don't listen to Danvers.
Basically. Right. Yeah. And that there's a little bit of a battle for Pete Pryor's soul between Danvers and his father. We see Hank being abusive to Pete. We find out like that, you know, that Pete's mother left. So, you know, Hank is probably being conned by this woman who's his, you know, who's his fiance.
Yeah, sending her money.
Sending her money. But, you know, we do get a little bit of humanizing detail that, you know, he suffered this loss of his wife leaving both him and Pete. He stuck around to raise Pete. So that's to his credit.
But he didn't make him sandwiches.
He stuck around. Yeah, exactly.
Let's move to Navarro, who this episode is, despite having been told that this case will sink you if you worry about Annie, is much like the dog who's being cared for by Eddie, is like a dog with a bone, is determined to continue investigating. And she does get some leads. She does go talk with, I believe I said last name, his name is Brian. I think now it's Ryan. This is Annie's brother. And he doesn't recognize a Raymond Clark, but it does seem like this other patron at the bar does. And so she's going to go, he works at the mine. She's going to go and learn that Raymond bought a trailer from this guy's cousin a while back, paid fully in cash. And we also learn a lot about Raymond through some of the things in terms of like scribbles and notebooks. He walked around naked and just a weird guy that nobody seemed to care about. So, or nobody seemed to like stop anything from happening. Navarro is doing some great detective work, all at the same time trying to potentially see if Julia will check into a place called the Lighthouse, which seems to be like a community.
Like a residential treatment facility. Yeah. We start with Navarro here in conversation.
Oh, yeah. With Rose.
That's right. And we get more details about Rose and Travis. I thought maybe Rose was Travis's mother.
Hopefully not.
And Travis.
This is HBO. HBO. Yeah.
But Travis is, we think, the father of one of the first season detectives.
Yeah, Rust. Yeah, Matthew McConaughey's character in season
one. Who lived in Alaska. So interesting tie in there. I want to say, like, I've heard in the Issa Lopez interviews that she had actually developed this story independently of the True Detective franchise, and then it became part of it. But it's nice to see that there's these, like, little fun Easter eggs there. So Travis died of leukemia, or actually, I'm sorry, he was terminal. He was going to die of leukemia and decided he didn't want the disease to take him. He wanted to go out into the ice.
A common theme in the episode is people becoming sick. The water's turning brown. There's somebody else has cancer in this, or had cancer in this. So there's a lot that the and they're like this place, the mind, this place. So
And so Rose has been seeing Travis. Like, she has this ability to see people who have passed away, and we find out it happened. It started with Travis. But she knows people who've been doing this their whole lives. And then we have a couple of references to, it's also this place. Rose says it. And then when Pete is interviewing Bill, the delivery guy for Sala, he says, you were born here. You know, it's this place. The long nights, even the dead get bored.
So the still, though, so he thinks he's seen somebody in the Tesala Arctic Station when he the night that they're all missing. If you look at the still, there's a still that's been floating around. I think it absolutely has to be Raymond. It's a person wearing gray sweatpants and the pink coat. So I think
he did indeed see somebody. But this, I love this theme that and I looked up this phenomenon called polar madness, and people who live in the Arctic Circle are susceptible to all of these mental health issues. I'm sure it surprises nobody that there are negative mental health effects of being in constant darkness, increased depression, irritability. There's even, you know, documented signs of a hallucination. There was there have been a few different, notable cases of people who, of polar expeditions that go wrong, with people descending into mutiny, lunacy, suicide, and cannibalism, and that have been attributed in part to polar madness. So I think that this could be something that Raymond Clark potentially was experiencing that was being ignored by his other peers at Sala, but also something that just is part of the town that. There's, as Rose says, that like the world is getting old, and Ennis is a place where things are starting to break down.
Can I read the quote, which is,
I would love you. Yeah.
It happens in us all the time. The world is getting old, and Ennis is where the fabric of all things is coming apart at the seams. It's breaking open. No.
Right. So this is one of the things that I love in storytelling, where there's this ambiguity of what here has a rational explanation as perhaps a mental health phenomenon, and what is actually something spiritual, and that how does that very real rational consequence weave its way into the lore of a place, of a culture, of a people. And, when Navarro is trying to confide in Rose that, her sister is having similar experiences, that Jules is having similar experiences of seeing Navarro's mother. And I think we get in flashbacks evidence that Navarro and Jules's mother was probably suffering from some sort of mental health issues. We see a cross that seems to be part of.
They seem to be somewhere warm, warmer, and the and seems like a woman is screaming. These two kids are like crying or confused, and then the flashback is sort of triggered by this cross pendant that she finds in her car, and then she chucks it out the window, almost hits a truck as well.
Yeah. So I think we get the impression that probably Navarro is older and was like a caretaker of her sister all of her life, sort of protecting her from their mother. And I thought it was really interesting that Rose says, don't confuse the spirit world with mental health issues. So Rose is like, no mental health issues.
She's awake. Rose is woke.
Very woke. but like, so she's, distinguishing that both of these things are real. Her experiences with Travis are this sort of spiritual communication with somebody from beyond the grave. But that there's also mental health issues, and that maybe that's what's happening to Jules. Maybe that's what's happened with Navarro's past. But this conversation I thought was really interesting in terms of setting up those two themes.
And I love, there's this line here where she says, okay, when you see these people, how do you stay okay? And Rose says, well, the thing about the dead is that some of them come because they miss you. Some come to tell you something you need to hear, and some want to just take you with them. And you need to know the difference. That feels pretty important. So there's two things. One is like, okay, is this actually happening? Am I having a mental health issue, or is this like the actual dead coming? And then why are they coming? Why are they here? So I really love this. I was really turned on my head in terms of like the Rose and Evangeline connection, just how close they seem. Just when they say
that was
goodbye.
Travis's last gift to Rose was bringing Evangeline into her life. Yeah,
it's very sweet. I think. Navarro is going to, and they're talking about how, so the symbol, there's also the symbol that appeared. It appears on someone's forehead in the ice. And Rose says, she's seen it before years ago. It's older than Ennis, maybe older than the ice. The other piece here is when Bryce is being interviewed. He is the teacher who Danvers was talking to. And we get some insight into what they were trying to discover, which is that they were looking for basically to bring back a nearly extinct a sequence of DNA of an extinct microorganism that would stop cellular decay. Great line here where she says, in English, please. He says, you should have effed the English teacher if you wanted in English. But basically, it'd be a game changer. It could basically cure cancer. But he thinks it's impossible.
Exactly. So they're working on this, like identifying this this very pre historic organism that would have all of these potential benefits. It would be a huge breakthrough in biological science and medicine. He thinks it's foolhardy because the permafrost damages the cellular material. But this is what they were working on here. It sounds like it's, you know, very secretive. I think it's interesting that, you know, this is a town where everybody knows each other. Nobody knows these scientists. He also mentions that unlike other polar expeditions, they don't turn over. They're there all the time. They keep to themselves. So I think
They don't shift change. They're all there. They're weird. They don't. Yeah, they're just weird people. Seemingly. Yeah,
they're very weird and isolated. I have to say, when we first saw this like Sala station, there's something to me as somebody who works in science that's very romantic about like science summer camp, and you go and you work with lots of your colleagues, and we find out more details when they interview the cleaning people that they were very, you know, serious about their work, that sometimes they played video games. This one guy kept to himself. But it sounds like, you know, to make those parallels with the Ralph Waldo Emerson and the Salal, you know, these other things that they really lived in this kind of isolated, very intense kind of situation.
Yeah. I want to chat a little bit about Eddie. Eddie's caring for this dog and her sister, Navarro's sister, is working there. Mm-hmm. Talking about how, you know, the water's turning black in some homes. There's talks of protest coming up again. One thing I want to note that we, you know, from last week too, and I know LaTanya touched this on on Versus, was the sexual encounter between the two of them last week. And that a lot of people saying that it, you know, I think LaTanya had said it converges on assault by Evangeline. I think that it's very complicated and I don't know the exact answer. I from a lot of what I think I interpret from the show is that he doesn't say like he's saying wait, and he's trying to, and I'm gonna get intimate here, but like prolong what's happening. Yeah. And he's not quite comfortable with it, but it does seem like, and this is maybe something to the, you know, to critique the show, that they could have done a better job of that. This is a little bit of what their relationship like, and as much as people might view it as problematic, that also it does seem like they are still together. There's no inkling that Eddie is and that's not to say that, like, because I think if the roles were reversed, it's very easy to say like, well, just because she's not uncomfortable with it doesn't mean it's not assault. Right. So it's very complicated. But it does, you know, but he's saying, like, you know, at the end of this, like, talking about this dog who's here, like, she's tough deep down, but, you know, when you get to know her, she just needs a little love and affection. And she's like, all right, well, I'll see you. I gotta go to work.
Yeah.
He's not gonna give that, and he wants more of it, but he's also, it does seem in some way, and consensual is maybe the word that's hard to put in here, but like, that there's, in a way, even though it's consensual, it's also consensual to a degree. So I it's very complicated, and I think the show certainly could be doing a better job at maybe articulating some of this stuff. But, you know, we see in the scene this week where from the typical dynamics we typically see, that the women are much more in control of some of these situations, specifically Danvers and Navarro, than maybe the men in these situations normally would be. And that seems to be a theme the show is playing at.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think it's a very fair point to bring up, like, the dynamics of that sex scene between Navarro and Kavik in episode one, and to question, you know, how consensual was this? Is this assault? And I think it's, you know, there's no objective way to view something and say definitively that because he said this and not this, and because he comes back the next day, we know it's consensual. Like, that's not how sexual politics work. So I think it's fair to point out, and I do think that the broader point that the show is making is that Danvers and Navarro, and in this world, we are looking, like, these are women who are taking a different empowered role with regard to their sexuality than we typically see, especially that we usually see in this kind of crime and detective genre. And, you know, that doesn't mean it's like it's woke for women to sexually assault men. I think it's just like the same way that, like, oh, because Danvers can be racist because she's a woman. Like, I would not say any of those things, but I do think that the show is playing with that lens and with those traditional archetypes.
Yeah. So Navarro is on the case for this trailer, this guy. There's a poignant point at the end of the scene where he says, like, why didn't you say this to me before? And he's like, it's because I don't like you that I didn't want to tell you any information. And she says, actually, I think it's because you didn't like Annie.
You were okay with what happened to her.
And he does not say anything, and he does not look her in the eye, and she leaves. So I think certainly probably true. We know she was a protester of the mind, but also just, again, these ways in which, like, you know, the right people are murdered, then you're okay. You know, that's, you know, oh, that sucks. But, you know, at least it was her. So it's pretty awful. Danvers also starts to investigate the tattoo, and we find out that Raymond had it tattooed on his chest 4 days after she died. There is a photo where she has the same tattoo of the two of them together. So this is going to bring, and then the DNA is proved to be a DNA match of Annie. So it is Annie's tongue in the case. And then as the thaw freezes, we're going to see, well, there's no Raymond Clark here. So he and Navarro is sure, because David says, well, maybe he got separated. And Navarro says, no, he didn't. He's alive. He's out there.
Yeah. So I think you nailed it, Grace. This was your prediction that it was Ray Clark on the pod.
Pretty low bar to be like the guy who, you know, has her coat might be the murderer, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. We get a ton of developments in the case. I thought it was a really fun complementarity. Like, we get like we learn a little bit about Liz's method of inductive reasoning, where, you know, it's like you have to, that's not the right question. Keep on asking questions. We see her and Pete go through this exercise where they're sort of reasoning through, okay, like why undress? Why leave so quickly? You know,
the thing is, like, why folded. Pete says, like, why weren't they wearing their shoes? And she says, no, not the right question. It's like, what would make you scared enough to go outside without your shoes or your clothes, right? That's the question. Yeah.
So what we learn here is that the symbol, you know, this other thing that Pete and Danvers sort of work out is that if somebody drew the symbol on the forehead of one of the bodies, that means that there was somebody else that was out there with them.
Folded
the killer.
Yes,
the clothes are folded. Somebody folded that. And then we also see this kind of echoed in when Navarro is with Kavik, you know, not sticking around to eat those delicious looking pancakes. Mm-hmm. She's reasoning through the case, and she does this. That's not the right question. And we get this impression that, you know, Navarro and Liz might have had this mentor-mentee relationship once upon a time that now we see with Liz and Pete, so that you know, sort of suggests that she, Navarro, learned a lot from Liz that's approached her way of being a detective. And then both Navarro and Liz do excellent work here. Liz tracks down the tattoo, finds the picture that puts Annie and Carver together. He got that tattoo 4 days after Annie died.
Yeah.
And then in parallel, we have Navarro discovering that Ray had this trailer. She ends up zeroing in on the location after figuring
very
out.
Very creepy inside.
Oh my God.
I don't like it.
It's like, this is it. Don't decorate like this, because if somebody finds your house and you have weird dolls hanging from the ceiling and strange.
I'm just going to cancel my appointment with Raymond Clark Interior Design. If you just give me a minute, I'll be back.
It's a good idea. So we discover this creepy trailer that we think he had as a way of carrying on his relationship with Annie in secret. And like, Raymond was losing his damn mind. Like, we see Liz is looking through his lab notebooks, and they're like littered with these, you know, with all of these doodles and text written like over and over again.
Yeah, always I need remember. To go back. Yeah. Do you have some of them?
I have always some of remember. It.
Okay.
Always remember, I can hear her coming, her name, her fingers, cold, don't forget, her eyes, her face, dark, dark, oh God, never sleep. Like, these are some of the things that are written in the lab notebook. So this, she's awake. There's more references to a female pronoun here, whatever this means. So is very interesting.
The video that they see, is that Raymond?
Yeah.
Shivering? Yeah.
Yes.
He's in the coat, right? So it's him. And then he's also still there a few days later, I believe, based on the one still frame I've seen. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The other weird thing is like these like dolls, these like woven mm-hmm. dolls, kind of like mannequin puppet. They're like, some of them are small and hanging from the ceiling. There's like basically a full-sized one in the bed. I don't know what to make of it.
I don't know.
No theory at the moment. Yeah.
The spiral is on the ceiling of the trailer above the bed.
Right. Right.
And Annie's cell phone is in the trailer as well,
which was not with her when she died. Yeah. So a big discovery here. This is it. The reason I said this, just to reiterate this from what I said at the beginning, is, you know, I thought, so Killers of the Flower Moon, which came out this summer, the book is written as mystery, and I do think it works for the book, but I do think it was a smart choice. In the movie, they basically, within the first, I don't know, 25 minutes, are like, yeah, this is who killed all these. This is who's going to kill all these people and who's doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
And the reason I think it is effective, and I, you know, I'd be interested to hear from Indigenous folks or marginalized groups, is that I think it's a little bit, it's not fun when this is so prevalent in our society that Indigenous women are murdered and killed. And it often is so blatant so the idea that that's not the mystery. The mystery here isn't that Indigenous women are murdered. We know that that happens. There's statistics to show that that happens. And so to play around with the mystery of like who did it, the real story here is like, you know, I still think of like the institutional systems and the way NS is structured to make sure that even though everyone knew Raymond Clark was walking around naked and being weird and scribbling in his research and, you know, up to something no good, nobody did anything. And why didn't they do anything? And that's what I think we're going to learn. So I think,
yes,
I called it last week, but I think it makes so much sense that this is, the story doesn't need to be like, who killed Annie? The story is like, what the hell's going on with like, are people hallucinating? Is all this, what's the, that's the mystery of the show.
And then like, what is the kind of this sort of Ennis killed Annie, you know, this point that, you know, that whatever, like Raymond Carver going mad and doing that, or Raymond Clark, is that his name? Raymond Clark going mad and killing this Indigenous woman isn't the story. The story is that everybody who works at the mine is okay with it happening, that Kate McKintrick, who controls everything in the town, lets this investigation go cold. The story is that the police department botches it and drops it eventually. So the story is that, you know, the water is black, people are being poisoned,
and nobody's doing anything about it.
So I think that that's what we're going to learn more. And I think that, you know, whatever the work is that's happening at Salal will have something to do with it as well. But, you know, I fully agree that that's the way that we're supposed to be watching this. And now, in addition to, you know, Raymond Clark, the other piece is going to be, how do we catch this guy?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we talked about the show being very horror-y. We talked about the scream at the beginning. Again, we mentioned at the beginning and then completely didn't talk about it again.
Yeah,
again, well, because it's almost like not, it basically is a jump scare, but then nobody's like, yeah, and one of the bodies was like fully alive. Like, that's pretty wild, huh? Like 3 days, just like for like nobody. No, that's not a thing. It's not a piece of evidence. So I wonder whether that's real or not.
Well, so I Googled, because I was like, I'm like, is this a horror element or is this supposed to be? Because that seems like a pretty big break in the case.
Yeah, the guy's almost like, yeah.
So I did the body count, and the person who's unaccounted for in the tangled mass of frozen flesh is obviously Raymond Clark, but also Anders Lund, who is the director of Salal. So probably the most critical person in terms of making connections to what is actually going on, potentially another bad guy, if not implicated directly in the killing of Annie, but whatever's happening with the water and the mine and Kate McKittrick. So he's a pretty heavy hitter of all of the people to have survived. He's in a medically induced coma. I looked up whether this was possible. Apparently in Pennsylvania, not that long ago, they did resuscitate somebody who had been frozen for multiple days. Wow. So it's, you know, even though this seemed completely bizarre and truly like a horror element, I guess that there's enough of that this is biologically plausible. So I have to imagine, Grace, that Anders is going to wake up sometime in the next 4 episodes and we're going to get to have a conversation with him.
Okay. We shall see. Okay. So yeah, that's episode 2. I thought, again, another really good episode. I'm excited to chat about it more on the deep dive. Of course, Mike Bloom and LaTanya, we're doing the Versus pod. I mean, any final thoughts on episode 2?
I think that we got into it all.
Good Vibrations, like, playing as they're moving all the bodies into the ice rink, I thought was no notes. And as somebody who grew up in a small town, the fact that just like, yeah, we gotta use the hockey rink, you know, not for this, but like, you know, just like everybody watching everything and knowing everything that's happening, I thought was pretty fun. I don't think I live quite this small town, but it's a pretty small town I grew up in.
This is a very small town. I do want to say, I did look up some population statistics about like Alaska and the Arctic Circle, like the number of people who live in this part of Alaska, and this is not a real town, so we can't look that up. I mean, it's like a small liberal arts school in this huge amount of space. Like the whole population of Alaska is like roughly the size of Boston. So like this is extremely sparsely populated, like a very small town. I think all of this adds to the eeriness of it. And the idea that you bring in this mass of dead bodies, and like it seems like they jumped the gun a little bit with taking the tarp off because people were still leaving the hockey game as this was happening.
Yeah, like, whoa. Lee's like, whoa, I just wanted to say I was going home. Like, get out of here. It's like, well, you put the tarp on, I don't know.
Yeah, leave the tarp on. Like,
the radio call as Liz is in the school going to talk to Bryce, and they're like, they're pretty tough to fit in the van, Chief. Should we try and break off a piece? You're like, no. that's pretty funny. I like
these
that.
People are not that good at their jobs, Grace.
No, no. Mm-hmm. But we're good at our jobs. We're gonna keep talking about it. So what else you got going on? Where can people find you, Amanda?
People can find me on PSR, where I am talking about 6 Feet Under with Ariel. We are into season 2 right now and having a great time with that rewatch. Grace, you and I got back together to do some more feedback on the season 1. I probably the only season, but who knows, of The Curse. We had a great, we got to talk about that finale and then do a feedback show to process everything that has continued.
I don't think we processed it. I don't
know. We're still not okay. Still processing. And I'm also on this week's episode of Renap, Ooh. Rob and Akiva, ask us anything. I got to sit down with Rob and Akiva and really ask the hard-hitting questions that the listeners want to know. That was very, very fun.
That's fun. What else? Full spoiler recaps. Jess and I will be chatting about Slow Horses this week, the Apple TV show with Gary Oldman. Aaron and I are chatting movies. Last week we chatted about Mean Girls the musical, and this week we should be chatting about ISS, International Space Station, space drama. I know, Dr. Manna, cover your ears. But I'm on social media at High From Grace, and we will be back next week for episode 3, the halfway point of the season. Until then, we'll be detectiving truly.